Hello, and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. I'm Karen Hughes, and I'm so glad to be out of Washington and back home living in Austin. I travel a lot these days, though, and I just heard that Evan Smith left Texas Monthly and has some new website. And now here's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you, Karen Hughes. Honestly, I don't know what publication she's talking about, but we should check it out because it sounds pretty good.
She needs a laugh track.
For her intro? I thought it was very good and informative, and I look forward to reading Evan Smith's new publication. Let's see. I'm reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the second week of March. Joining me is Tribune editor Emily Ramshaw.
Hi there.
Hello. Tribune reporter Julian Aguilar.
Hello.
And special guest from the Texas Politics Project over there at the University of Texas, Professor Jim Henson.
Thank you, Reeve, and thanks for the ride to the Tribcast.
He's been public school educated through and through.
That's right. Jim Henson has never gone to a private school. That's what we learned in our, which is, you know.
That's one of the things.
We should mention that Evan and Ross are not here because they are at family knitting camp for spring break.
Are you going to elaborate on that?
Well, you know, I mean.
This is our first topic.
They are the slackers who take spring break off.
Oh, yes. Unlike the rest of the office, which has been diligently working despite South by Southwest being in town. We've made it to the office despite South by Southwest being in town, which was a challenge. We're going to be talking about general political update, then the women's health program, and also the latest with voter ID. Let's just start and knock politics out of the way, because last night Rick Santorum won Mississippi and Alabama. Which means that this thing is going to take a bit longer to be settled.
You seem unhappy about that.
I'm a little bit ready to move on, you know. With
the general?
Yeah. I would like to. It's like one of those things where, you know, you want to just get to the next book in the series.
The good news is it's making all of these states that aren't used to being very relevant, very relevant.
And it's potentially saving our own state, which lost its relevance, to becoming relevant again, right?
Exactly.
Right.
No matter how late our primary is, we may actually have a shot at being relevant.
So you're saying you're happy that Alabama and Mississippi are more relevant?
And the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Do we think the new Gingrich American is going to be dropping out?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of talk about whether Gingrich is dropping out. If Ross was here, he would give us the summary of what happened yesterday, which is that...
I just did. I said he won. I said Santorum won.
And Romney placed third, right? So, you know, roughly they're still splitting, you know, give or take, third, a third, a third. But with Gingrich running consistently in you know, not being able to win anything, there's a lot of pressure on Gingrich to get out right now. Questions about whether his, you know, super PAC donors will continue to give him money and support this. He's acting like he's not getting out, and there's all kinds of, you know, weirdness coming from conservative commentators, from urging him to get out to talking about, you know, the brilliance of a Santorum Gingrich ticket, et cetera, et cetera.
Can that be viewed as a second loss for Perry, since he endorsed Gingrich, and there have been all these like Gingrich Perry rumors, or is that reaching?
Yeah, right. What does this mean for the, you know, Rick Perry could be a VP nod, and they're having these quiet conversations about it, blah blah blah.
Well, they might be having those conversations are probably very quiet about right now. You know, I mean, as Emily says, I mean, the interesting thing from the local angle is that all of a sudden our May 29th primary, you know, could possibly matter a little bit more. I think it almost certainly means, unless Santorum crashes between now and the end of May, that we'll see a little more advertising from the Romney campaign, a little more activity from Romney here than I think we might have otherwise.
Do these candidates have like coattails that extend to other races? For example, Craig James is now doing a pro Santorum tour around Texas.
Well, you know, I
you're giggling about the phrase pro Santorum?
No, I'm giggling about Craig James.
Choose your giggles.
Yes, to be fair. You know, I mean, I think it's not so much coattails as, you know, there is a question of if Santorum is an active alternative and is out there, does it stoke the fires of the very conservative base, which I was, you know, wrote about today in the Tribune, as it turns out. And I think that's
the Tribune.
That's one of the questions.
Shameless plug.
Yes, and that's one of the questions, I think, is that, you know, does the very presence of Rick Santorum bring out more conservative voters, somehow activate them if it's a little bit more competitive? And I don't think we know yet. I think we're gonna have to see what it looks like as it gets closer, because I think it's still not a sure thing that we're going to be
that we're going to
the
matter.
Center of the universe.
Be careful what you say here.
Yeah, I know that's sacrilege.
Well, what have some of the latest polling numbers said? I mean, I saw that there were some new poll numbers out yesterday.
Yeah, there was a Rasmussen poll that came out yesterday that was a one-day phone poll that had Romney actually, I think, up by a point or two. And so, you know, that shows some movement. When we were in the field a month before that, we went in the field and got Santorum way up, but that was right after he had just won those three primaries. It was before the contraception thing had hit. I mean, we hit him at his peak, and he had dropped, if you look at the polls on a straight line, which, you know, is a little bit tricky, he dropped, you know, 10, 12 points. So.
Well, speaking of the contraception thing and stoking the, you know, conservative fires, and this is a political fight that Perry has actually been more directly involved with lately, so we could transition to that. Today is the deadline for what, Emily?
Today is the day that the new Texas law goes into effect that says that Planned Parenthood and other, you know, so-called affiliates of abortion providers can no longer participate in the women's health program.
Who are those other affiliates?
There are some other clinics that, you know, are sort of smaller clinics that perform abortions at some of their clinics, but, you know, not at all of them. Obviously, under this women's health program, which is a Medicaid program, it's a joint federal-state program, already no clinics that accept money under this program can perform abortions. So, you know, we did not have a situation where abortions were being performed, you know, with tax dollars, allegedly. You know, the argument from Republicans is that they just want Planned Parenthood out of Texas. They know that Planned Parenthood refers to clinics that provide abortions. You know, they don't believe that Planned Parenthood is actively sort of segregating the money they get for tax dollars, you know, for women's health from their abortion funding. So the reality here is that basically starting today, the feds are going to say we're cutting off the funding. You know, this program can't be operated as a joint state-federal program because we, the federal government, think you, Texas, are breaking the law by excluding women, Planned Parenthood from the women's health program.
Should we just clarify what the women's health program does?
Right. The women's health program basically provides about 100,000 women in Texas with contraception, with certain kinds of cancer screenings, STD tests. So basically, it serves the poorest women in Texas, but does not provide abortions.
And so are they going to lose that service?
So here's what's going to happen. Rick Perry has basically, my personal opinion is that Rick Perry has actually done something really smart here. He's shifted this fight from a fight about contraception to being a fight about just Planned Parenthood. And he's done that by saying, okay, federal government, you're not going to provide the $30, $35 million a year that you've been providing. Guess what? Texas is going to do it. We're going to find it somewhere in our totally strapped budget. You know, we're going to run this program the way we want to run it. We'll decide the women who are qualified for it. We'll decide who the providers are. You know, you can keep your money.
Why, I mean, not why, but how could we possibly find the money after the session we had last
right.
time
I mean,
around?
That is the big question. You know, there is funny math, as Ross would say, where you can sort of find money certain places. But I think, you know, the answer is probably it's going to have to get tacked on to some kind of Medicaid shortfall. Perry has said to Health Commissioner Tom Cease, basically, you know, Tom, you find the money somewhere in your budget and you just let me know where it is. But I think the question is where they're going to find that money. And also, I mean, at the end of the day, the really big question is, you know, 40% of women currently served by this program are served by Planned Parenthood. So the question is, are there the resources in the state? Are there enough doctors and clinics not affiliated with Planned Parenthood who can care for these women? And no matter what side of this issue you're on, I think this is really a wait and see. We just don't know yet.
This is a basic capacity question.
Total capacity question.
Yeah.
Emily, some state lawmakers wrote to the commissioner this morning asking to meet and talk about some alternative funding methods. Is that going to get anywhere? Or is that just, you know,
I don't think
so. Trying to get their name in the news?
You know, again, at the end of the day, the federal government thinks it's a violation of federal law to cut Planned Parenthood or any provider out of this program. Now, I think there's some wiggle room there. There are other waivers that the federal government has given states that have allowed them to sort of pick and choose between providers. So at the end of the day, there is a big abortion battle, you know, a Planned Parenthood battle, the Obama administration versus Texas here.
Right. I think to go away from policy for a minute to the area that I always get to is politics. I mean,
you're going to start singing or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Someone will give me right. a minute.
Philosophy.
Yeah. You know, we we were talking, you know, a few months ago, what would happen, a couple of months ago, what would happen when Perry came back? How would he reassert his authority? And clearly this zone of state, of state authority and state autonomy versus the federal government is an area right in his wheelhouse. He's very comfortable. And it's interesting. I think now he's picked, he's in the middle of a couple of big fights over this.
But it's also something that he sort of, it got away from him during his presidential campaign a little bit on the states' rights thing, especially around, at first he said, you know, certain states, like if New York wants to have gay marriage, then they can do that and you can move to New York. And that was part of his stump speech. And then that turned out to not be working too well.
Right.
So it moved to like, oh, well, we should, for that, we should have a federal solution.
I think this is even more specific than that between, you know, this, the Planned Parenthood and the Women's Health Program issue and the voter ID issue, which we'll get to. The politics of this are very much, on one hand, something that he's very comfortable with, but both of them, is, I mean, Emily and I were talking earlier in the week, pose some political hazard for him. I mean, I think they're not ideal, but it is an area that I think he is trying to reassert himself.
Well, because even if you say that he's made this smart play to make it more about Planned Parenthood than contraception, it's still a fight that sort of Texas has chosen to pick, right? I mean, they're the ones changing their rules from what they've been previously, knowing full well that this will have this result.
Right, although their argument is, you know, that the federal government for years has, you know, it's been against the law to use any kind of state or federal funding for abortions, and that's sort of what they insinuate is happening here. You know, I think, again, there's going to be this sort of political question of whether this affects Perry. You know, are these the battles he really wants to be picking? Clearly, the states' rights stuff is, as Jim said, totally in his wheelhouse. It's, you know, where he wants to be. Does he want to be doing it with women, and does he want to be doing it with Hispanics? Reeves, stop laughing, is the question. You know, are these the fights that he wants to be picking? So we can head to Julian for voter ID before.
No, we're still on this topic.
Oh, well, I mean, I think the voter ID stuff really plays into this, and that's the question of who you want to pick your fights with.
All right, okay. So play into this, Julian.
Okay, so voter ID, as expected, Monday morning, the Department of Justice denied the state's request for preclearance, which is a procedure that under the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act has to go through. Nobody was really surprised. Attorney General Greg Abbott said on Thursday, you know, we're anticipating this is going to be denied. That's why the Attorney General filed suit in January to have the law implemented immediately. So that's where we are now. MELC, the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus, and the Texas chapter of the NAACP have filed a motion to intervene in this suit, and the Department of Justice has until April 9th to respond to the Attorney General's complaint. So it's kind of in the wait-and-see mode, but, I mean, May 29th is coming up. There will be no voter ID, so we'll see how, you know.
So anyone can go and, you know, commit as many fraudulent votes as they want.
Exactly, because depending on who you ask, that's a huge problem where it's not a problem at all.
Well, what were the grounds for rejecting it were that the state failed to prove that it would not be discriminatory?
Yeah, and the state had said that it was facing an uphill battle from the get-go. They initially asked for preclearance in July, and there was it's been 8 months later, and there was various exchanges. The Department of Justice said, well, you know, you're not giving us the numbers that we need. We're specifically interested in this, you know, about 605,000 people that do not have IDs but are registered voters. We want their racial breakdown, where they live, how many are Latino, how many are not Latino. And the funny thing is, the Secretary of State's office said, you know, we don't ask people what their race is when they register to vote, because doing so would, I'm sure, be some sort of violation of the Voting Rights Act. And now the Department of Justice is saying, well, you know, under the Voting Rights Act, you have to provide this information. So literally there was like at least four or five exchanges between the state and the federal government on information. No, we need more information. Okay, well, this is some more information, back and forth, until finally in January, 2 weeks after the law was supposed to be implemented, the Department just said, okay, well, we have 60 days from this, you know, from this starting point. Lo and behold, they denied it. So now we're going to see what the district court in D.C. says. And attorneys for both MALC and the NAACP say, you know, the burden of proof is on the state. The state has to prove to this court that, you know, minority rights are not going to be infringed upon. And this is all going down regardless of what the Department of Justice said. So in essence, this process starts all over in the courts.
It's tough to prove a negative, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument. But it's interesting because the El Paso Times editorial board came out a while back saying, voter ID, it's not going to harm people. And, you know, El Paso's, you know.
But the numbers, some of the numbers in the DOJ thing were pretty, I mean, large, like they said. Wasn't it Hispanic registered voter is at least 46.5% less likely to have the necessary ID or something.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It said, you know, it's,
what have you been reading?
That's the one thing I read this week.
But that's, you know, a Hispanic voter is 46.5% more likely than a non-Hispanic voter to lack these forms of identification. You know, for whatever reason, I mean, that statement in and of itself screams like, wait, something is wrong here. Something is wrong. And people say, you know, I mean, how many of us here sitting here have a valid state-issued ID? But then they get into, like, little snags. Emily, have you changed your name since you got married on your ID?
Yes, but I waited in that long line at the DMV to change it.
See, and a lot of people are worried about maybe the election workers say, you know, if your address doesn't... I'll confess, I renewed my driver's license last month, and I had an address that was, you know, 3 or 4 years old on there. If I tried to vote, would it match on the rolls? Would it not match on the rolls? Is somebody going to look at that? Do they know to look at that? And, you know, but on the other hand, I mean, you know... You rent a movie if people still rent movies. Buy a pack of smokes. Yeah, buy a six-pack.
You don't need an ID for Netflix.
Exactly. How much of this is, you know, I mean, how much does the right hand know what the left hand's doing? How much are these agencies, you know, under the Obama administration just wanting to sort of, you know, either pick fights with Texas or Texas wants to pick fights with them? I mean, is there any way to know how much of that is going on behind the scenes?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, are they doing this on purpose, or are they singling Texas out? They're certainly not singling Texas out.
No, because they've rejected similar laws.
They've rejected
South Carolina.
I mean, I think, I think the right hand and the left hand at the Justice Department have a fairly consistent
argument,
you know, approach to these things. That is, we went through a period where the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department was at the top, led by people that were not especially interested in civil rights. And we know that. They were pretty public about it. Mm-hmm. And now they are. So I think there is a fairly consistent application in here. And I would really urge people to go and read the letter. The letter that the Justice Department sent to Texas is very interesting. It lays out a lot of interesting information. The reasoning is very clear. I mean, you were talking about, you know, you had to go wait in line to get your ID. Part of the problem, and it's a very nice empirical treatment, is they looked at the number of counties, travel distance to a DMV office, cost of getting a duplicate birth certificate, mm-hmm. broke that down using demographic categories in the various counties, and you can get reasonably close to figure out where and specifically how the law was going to have a disparate impact on minority populations.
Yeah, they have a number. I mean, several dozen counties that don't even have a local, DPS driver's license office.
Right.
There's the issue of, you know, immigrants that were born, you know, a midwife, you know, they don't have a birth certificate, or that's very difficult for them to get an original copy, you know. Social Security card, things of that nature. I mean, you know, everybody sitting at this table, you know, $20-$30 for a duplicate. I mean, it's inconvenient, but yeah, maybe we can afford it. But there are a lot of folks out on the border that argue, no, we can't. I mean, we are on a very, very fixed income. We haven't had a cost of living adjustment. Our retirement isn't what it used to be and things like that. So one could make the argument. And in 2009, when obviously everybody remembers that it almost just kind of shut down the session toward the end of the 81st, one El Paso lawmaker, you know, she put in perspective, said, look, if voter ID comes into play, then I lose the Chelsea Towers, is what she said, and this is a senior citizen's home. She said most of those people have lived there for years. They don't need a driver's license. And this is where, at least traditionally on the border, the cañoneros come out. People bus people to the polls.
Right.
And they, you know, whether they tell them how to vote or not, that's we can talk about that for 2 hours another week. But, I mean, she made a valid
two-hour podcast.
Yeah. She made a valid point.
That's how we're going to spend the summer.
Well, especially
our six listeners are out there collapsing, going, please don't.
We'll break it up into segments. But especially on the border where the primary is pretty much the general election. I mean, some of these elections go down to, you know, just hundreds of votes. And, you know, if there's a large segment that, you know, you exclude that out, then obviously these lawmakers have a vested interest in fighting this bill. But again, you know, the argument on the other side is, you know, I mean, I've had an ID since I was 16 years old. You know, the sideways, you know, picture that you look, you know, when you're under 18. I mean, I remember that, and I've had an ID, so what's the problem? So,
was this avoidable? I mean, you mentioned sort of right off the bat that, sort of as predicted, mm-hmm. the Justice Department has rejected this. But, you know, if you look at the New York Times editorial, which, you know, sort of predictably came out in favor of the Justice Department's decision, mm-hmm. and what they were hitting the legislature for was, you know, this amendment was offered to make this easier,
yeah.
and they rejected it.
They did.
And this amendment was offered, which was, you know, an even better sort of compromise from their perspective, and they rejected that. And they just rejected everything to make this sort of as hardline as possible.
Sure.
Did the people that wanted this bill to pass get anything from that, or they just set up this battle for later? Or maybe that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I'm sure if you ask, you know, you ask the authors of the bill, I'm sure they would say, no, we'd like to have it now. But, I mean, you're exactly right. Going back, there were, I mean, Jim, how many amendments were there during that battle?
Yeah, there were three figures.
Yeah, I mean, it was just,
yeah. I mean,
it
was,
well, it's something they've been debated for multiple sessions.
Sure.
Right. Well, the other issue there, too, is, I mean, not to, you know, downplay the work done by the New York Times editorial writers, but all that amendment process was referred to in the DOJ letter. Yeah. And that's another thing. I mean, I think that's a subtlety here moving forward is that, you know, as ineffectual as the Democrats have been, particularly in the last session, given their numbers, I think there were times when people thought that the Democrats were being obstructionist by mounting these amendments for the record, but they wound up being important.
Sure. Oh, and they knew what they were doing. I mean, you'd have lawmakers say, you know, every time you go up, I mean, just write this down. This is going to come back into play. You know, the same way the, you know, during redistricting or just whatever, they were already setting up a court argument, you know, the court battle, and they were smart. Did it stall the process? Yeah. Was it frustrating for a lot of people? Yeah, including people covering the issue. But, you know, inevitably, this is what they got. And, you know, everybody here has covered court cases, and everybody knows that those don't aren't usually figured out very quickly. So this
is what happens next with this?
The next step is the Department of Justice responds to the Attorney General's complaint, and this is April 9th is when that is due. And then after that, you know, we'll see what happens with the NAACP intervention.
Is there a chance that voter ID, the law, could be in place by November?
I don't think so. Jim, you're shaking your head.
Pretty small.
Yeah.
Pretty small.
But there's a chance.
So you're saying there's no chance
it could be by May 29th.
I said pretty small. Yeah. Oh, by May. Yeah, by this time.
By May, there's zero chance.
Zero chance.
So there might be a 1%, 2%.
Yeah, I'm not going to put a number on it, but
what about by
the small.
Next legislative session? Will we still be debating this?
Or will they be trying to, you know, amend the legislation that they have to, you know, add in elements that'll make it acceptable?
I mean, it depends. I mean, is there going to be a special session for anything on education, for women's health? I mean,
women's health.
Yeah, for funding anything, right. You know. I mean, could it get tacked onto anything, which it's all up in the air. But one thing that is interesting to note, though, if for some reason the green light was given, they said, okay, fine, your voter ID law, you know, run with it. The Secretary of State said it is already prepared to go on with the voter ID education and the outreach that they're required to do under SB 14. And they said as soon as we get the green light, it's out there and we're ready to go. So that, according to the Secretary of State, there shouldn't be any sort of snags because of the outreach that they have to do because they've been working on that since January 1.
But you said there won't, Emily, you said there won't be a special session on women's health, but surely that will be a hot topic in the next session, given what's going on this year.
Maybe, or maybe not. I mean, it sort of depends on whether there's any money for it. Likely, they'll have to come back.
Didn't Perry just promise that they were going to come up with some money?
Yes, but it may be a chance that they can come up with that money without necessarily having to come back before the legislature. Yeah. Or, you know, they come back in January and they have to find some sort of supplemental appropriations. But, you know, at the same time, there have been major cuts to women's health. You know, family planning budget was slashed by 2/3 this last session. I don't think we're going into a legislative session where we're going to have, you know, all this ample, you know, cash to spare.
Could some of that fuzzy math, though, come from the estimates that are coming out, or the revenues that are coming out that are higher than what was projected?
I think that's the hope. I also think that there was money that was, you know, appropriated away from family planning last session into some areas that haven't, you know, necessarily been spent. There's been some rumblings that there was some money appropriated for mental health that hasn't been spent yet, that they might be able to move over into the family planning realm. So, you know, I think it's going to be a wait and see. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, you were talking about litigation on your end. I think it's going to be curious to see whether there are any lawsuits or any class actions that could be filed around women's health. I think, you know, Planned Parenthood right now is sort of trying to figure out what their next step is. They've been having all of these big rallies. They've been, you know, on this statewide bus tour. But so far, I haven't heard anybody say, and we've got this great new lawsuit we want to file. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the move that Perry has made, they're pretty hamstrung. So,
well, I think it's going to depend a little bit on the composition of the legislature, which, you know, is obviously very much up in the air right now. The electoral system is so, you know, flummoxed by the, you know, both the presidential primary being so weird, our primary being so late. But, you know, I was, you know, talking to Democrats. I mean, the estimates are they're going to pick up, you know, they're still trying to figure out what the range is, and there's a lot of, you know, fantasy projection going on. But they're likely to pick up at least some seats, in part as a result of redistricting.
It's hard to lose some at this point.
Yeah, right. whether it's, you know, somewhere in the range of 8 to 12 or it's more than that, It depends on the optimism of the person you're talking to. Right. But that'll affect that dynamic. I mean, talking to Trey Martinez Fisher when he was at UT a couple weeks ago, you know, his view is they needed to get back up to about 60 to be able to really affect things directly again. And they seem confident that they can get pretty close to that. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, and this might get more into the political wheelhouse of yours, Jim. But one thing about both of these issues is that it is both sort of the issue and the debate sort of is much greater than what anyone has proved the perceived problem to be, right? I mean, no one has proved that there's massive voter fraud going on. The numbers for Planned Parenthood when it comes to abortions are pretty small. Are both of these really just political fights sort of in search of an actual, you know, solutions that beget political fights in search of problems?
And in his response to the decision, the Attorney General had, you know, two paragraphs on instances of voter fraud. And one would expect, you know, volumes upon volumes if this was such a problem that a lot of people say it is. But then, again, on the other side,
maybe he's just, you know, a concise writer.
Perhaps.
Ernest Hemingway.
Exactly.
Instead of a Faulkner.
Right.
Yeah. But on the flip side, you know, it's just like voting is a cherished right. And any, you know, whether it's one ballot that's cast by a person that shouldn't be, you know, I mean, that stains the system and it's about the integrity or whatnot. So, but a lot of people argue, even moderates say, look, this isn't really a huge, huge problem. What is more of a problem, people on the left argue, is the fact that Texas's voter turnout is, you know, if not at the bottom, very close to the bottom, you know, with voter ID, without voter ID. I mean, it's always, am I wrong in saying that in the last general election, it was like, what, 50 out of 51, if you include the District of Columbia?
It was close.
Yeah.
It was close to the bottom.
So people are saying, look, that's a bigger problem, you know? I mean, if you, you know, get it up to 40-45%, you know,
what do you think of, if voting is like a cherished thing, yeah, you know, very sacred part of our democracy and whatnot, you know, should it be easier?
You said that with such deep feeling.
Yeah. Should it be easier to do than renting a movie, or should the bar be higher?
Well, that's the argument. People say, look, I mean, you're making all these comparisons to, you know, buying beer, buying a pack of cigarettes, or renting a movie. I mean, that's a privilege. That's something that you earn. If you're born a U.S. citizen, you become a naturalized citizen. This is something that's bestowed upon you. It's a right. You shouldn't have any more hoops other than to prove your citizenship. So, I mean, again, that we'll save that for the 2-hour podcast that's coming up. Just kidding.
Well, Emily, what do you think about the
political?
Yeah.
You know, I think with the abortion stuff, there are always, you know, people who are sort of fiercely on one side. And I think the reality is it's somewhere in the middle here. I mean, whether Planned Parenthood's effect can be replaced or not is sort of yet to be seen. I mean, there are a lot of Republicans who think Planned Parenthood is such a big, powerful organization. They're so politically mobilized. You know, why don't they send some of that money down to Texas and make these clinics really just literally nonprofits that operate without tax dollars? There are tons of nonprofits around the country that operate without tax dollars. You know, could Planned Parenthood do that? Probably. You know, I mean, I think it's been a big hit and some of these clinics have had to close, but at the end of the day, they're very mobilized, a lot more than a lot of these smaller clinics are. You know, on the other side of that, the reality was abortions were not happening at these clinics, and they weren't happening with tax dollars. And as much as Republicans want to argue that that has been happening, I don't think there's any evidence that that money has not been, you know, segregated.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a mixture of policy and politics in both areas, right? I mean, but certainly in terms of the of Planned Parenthood, there's been a lot of political capital invested in making Planned Parenthood a symbol of abortion, a symbol of, you know, liberal politics, if you will, in the state, that is certainly divorced from the reality, to my mind, of the services they deliver and the breakdown of what they do in the communities they're in. I think there's really kind of no two ways about that.
Right. You know, I think something that's sort of been overlooked in this is that for a lot of women, Planned Parenthood is not just the only available provider in their community. It's the only provider they really feel safe going to. I mean, you know, you go to these clinics and it's the only place where it's all women generally. I mean, I know men go there for services, but when you walk into a waiting room, you know, it's pretty much all women. They're often in their neighborhoods. It's somewhere you go, not like your family you know, neighborhood clinic where you're going to see, you know, the grandpa down the street, and you're going to see, you know, the men in your neighborhood too. It has been a safe and private place for a lot of women in a lot of communities. And I think that is what is sort of at greater risk of being lost here. Not, you know, the state's going to continue to provide the money for these services. The question is whether the women will go get the services when they're not at Planned Parenthood.
When they have, it's a brand loyalty, right? I mean, right. The brand denotes a certain quality of service like any brand does. It also, the brand is also what's hurting them politically.
And right. It's interesting.
Speaking to that anonymity, I mean, do they ask any sort of residency or immigration status for these women to go in there?
No, not at all. Okay. I mean, this, and you know, and again, a lot of like federally qualified health centers also wouldn't ask those questions. But, you know, there's also not a lot of reliance. Texas is now saying, we're going to run this program. We're going to do it as good as we did it when the feds were involved. But history tells us that the Texas legislature has not wanted to fund family planning. Again, we are just coming off a session where they cut, you know, $70 million out of the state's family planning budget. So I think a lot of folks don't have a whole lot of trust that, well, maybe Perry's doing it now because he's under political pressure. Planned Parenthood is making such a scene nationally. You know, but what happens a year from now or 2 years from now? And does this just become yet another casualty? You know, do we not have this money at all in 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, and to the extent you're talking about politics, I mean, if you boil this down, these are issues for Republican primary voters. I mean, you look at the, you know, the abortion numbers, there's, you know, support for abortion rights in various tiers, and obviously, you know, Republican opposition and conservative opposition to abortion rights is much higher than it is among the general population. So there is, to me, a kind of irreducible political element to this. But, you know, the party is speaking to its base. And as long as, you know, the base is, you know, is dominating the party.
So you can read about all about these issues and more in your local Doonesbury comic.
Yes.
unless your newspaper has refused to run it.
That is worth talking about a little bit.
Oh, we have 1 second if you want to say something. I like that the lawmaker in it. So Doonesbury is running all these things about the Texas abortion sonogram laws. The lawmaker in it is Sid Patrick, which is a mix of Sid Miller and Dan Patrick. It looks more like Sid Miller, though. I don't wonder if Dan Patrick feels shafted.
If he's written a letter to Trudeau. Dear Northeastern liberal Yankee cartoonist.
If you would like to send us any letters, you can send them to tribcast@texastribune.org. You can tweet them with the hashtag tribcast. You can put them on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Texas Tribune. And I think that's it. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. On behalf of Jim, Emily, Julian, and our producer, Todd, thanks for listening.
Todd, can you take care of this? Jim Henson needs a glamour shot.